From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, white knuckles over Greece, harassment, and Herman Cain, and the Occupy movement shuts down a port. At the G20 summit in Cannes, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the euro comes first, whether a teetering Greece comes along or not.
The euro needs to be kept stable. We want to achieve this rather with Greece than without Greece.
An old scandal haunts GOP candidate and businessman Herman Cain. Harassment charges, women paid off, trouble, and denial.
In all of my over 40 years of business experience, running businesses and corporations, I have never sexually harassed anyone.
In Washington, the U.S. eyes its own debt and bottom line issues. Elder statesman Erskine Bowles told the Congressional Supercommittee that he was worried about their rescue mission.
I have great respect for each of you individually, but collectively, I'm worried you're going to fail.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with New York Times reporter Louise Story, Dallas Morning News columnist Bill McKenzie, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Will Europe keep it together? Will Herman Cain hang on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Louise Story joins us today from New York. She's a business reporter for the New York Times. Louise, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. From Dallas, Texas, we're joined by Bill McKenzie, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, great to have you with us again.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Bill, and Louise.
Louise, take us straight to Europe, if you would. What a week this has been. Last week, we're told we've got a deal. Everything's in order. This week, the Greek prime minister, president, leader says, we're going to have a referendum on this. Everything goes up in a kind of a wild gnashing of teeth. Now maybe that's off. Is Europe on top of Greece's situation? Is it on top of its own situation?
You know, there are still a lot of people on Wall Street who are even betting that the euro might not survive. When that deal came out last week, people were very quick to point out, okay, well, the political leaders say they have a deal, but they don't have buy-in from the investors in the Greek debt. And what you saw this week in Greece with the possible referendum, which has now been called off, is this internal struggle in Greece. It's a question of growth versus austerity measures. You know that there have been many cuts in Greece put in place so that they could get money from the eurozone and from the other European countries. But that's hurt Greece's economy. The number of thousands of businesses have cut down because of these cuts. And so we're watching this very carefully. The other thing this week that's very important is that the euro crisis really hit an American financial institution for the first time. So MF Global, a firm here that was run by John Corzine, former governor of New Jersey, they collapsed. They filed for bankruptcy because they had bought a lot of European debt.
John Corzine, former governor of New Jersey, Democrat, also former head of Goldman Sachs, and he was really exposed when this thing came down.
He had bought up through a series of complex deals over $6 billion of the debt of countries like Spain and Italy. And, you know, what happened was when that came out and they got downgraded, there was a run on the bank in the sense of a run on MF Global, just like we saw in the 2008 financial crisis when people on Wall Street lost confidence in Bear Stearns and Lehman and stopped trading with them.
40-1 leverage, we read in MF Global, John Corzine's company. Louise, I mean, is there more of this buried in Europe's debt crisis? Could we be? I mean, this is just one company, but if this thing really hits the wall, could we see another meltdown on Wall Street in the USA as a result?
Well, you have had people all week long saying, okay, who else? There were a lot of concerns yesterday about a firm called Jefferies, which is another mid-sized trading firm. In fact, the stock exchange had to temporarily halt trading in Jefferies because the stock plummeted 20% in just a few minutes. So they stopped trading it. You know, Jefferies came out very defensively and said they do not have a problem with the European debt holdings, that they had hedged those holdings. But there's just a lot of fear on Wall Street. The financial crisis that happened in the United States is very fresh. And, you know, our financial markets are very connected to Europe.
Jack, Bill, I want to come to you on where we stand with regulation, that this might still be such a risk all these years after the huge collapse in 08. But let's listen in on Europe for a minute first. G20 meeting going on running can, all the leaders there, including President Obama, and including the leader of China, to whom Europe's eyes have turned for cash. Here was French President Nicolas Sarkozy there saying the message sent by France and Germany at the summit was trying to help Greece to realize what was at stake here, making nice with Greece after a pretty tough week and more of comments from the French and Germans. Here he is speaking through an English translator.
Simply put, things are progressing. We're taking a great interest and total attention to what's going on in Greece. And I think the message that was sent to the entire Greek political class yesterday by Germany and France together has helped in sort of realization of how things might develop, and I think that in Greece they've realized this, and we think everybody is very interested in seeing that happen.
Nice tones there through the interpreter from Sarkozy. The Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, was there also at the G20 talking with reporters in Cannes yesterday, saying it's important to put the European bailout, well, he was thinking, to a national vote. Of course, it didn't come to that, but maybe there's a consensus emerging anyway.
We need to have a wide consensus, because the program we are facing is difficult in implementation, but I believe the Greek people want us to be a strong partner in the euro.
Jack, you can see this Greek leader just struggling with this week. The future that was laid before his country in this bailout was a very, very tough one. He turned to the idea of a referendum. Now, he's backed away from that. Europe and the world went sort of nuts about that because of the Greek people had said no. Who knew what that meant? On the other hand, this is the home of democracy, and his people have a tough road ahead if they sign up for the medicine that's being doled out here.
They certainly do, and European commentators this morning are raising just that issue, Tom, of democracy. Here you had the leaders of the, Sarkozy and Merkel basically telling the leader of another government, no, you can't do that. You can't do what you want. You can't appeal to the people on this. That is a defeat for the democratic will there. And, perhaps there was no alternative, but it's a spectacle that is chilling. I mean, finance, it would seem to have trumped a popularly elected government. Now, I'm not defending the government; it has all sorts of problems. But last week when they cut the debt by half, that looked like significant. But then when you looked at the numbers, it still meant a decade or more of near penury for the people of Greece, and they need to have a buy-in to that. They can't just, it can't just happen to them like fate. They should be able to decide it, but they're not going to this time. And in all of this, there has been a punitive feeling coming somewhat out of Germany. Eat your spinach. You didn't do the right thing. You've got to pay us back. Well, of course, there can be a self-defeating element of that unless if you become so draconian, as it were, that the economy, the Greek economy can't grow and the bankers can't be paid back because there's no growth.
On the other hand, it was quite a lark while it lasted. Bill McKenzie, you're our editorial columnist here. As you watch the Greeks wiggle on this rough hook that they're on now, what are you thinking about this country? And, we'll talk about the super committee here, but, we're grappling with our own bottom line in this country and watching this play out in real time in Greece.
Yeah, no, if we need further warning, well, here it is. Take a look. And this is also one more example of the global economy, which I'm in favor of. I'm not opposed to, but this is one of the risks in the global economy. Most of us are probably listening to, the minutiae that's going on in Greece, and frankly, we just don't understand it. We don't know it. It's 1,000 miles away. Well, you know what? It affects our economy here. There are investors in Dallas, Houston, Boston, Chicago, elsewhere who are placing bets on the international economy. They get affected. Their goods, they're shipped through the ship channel in Houston to Europe all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if Europe kind of craters in the worst-case scenario? Well, that's going to affect jobs here in Texas. It'll affect it elsewhere. So, we're all linked together. The other thought I've had listening to all this whole discussion, and I'm in favor of European integration, but I bet there are a lot of people, if you dial the clock back 20 years ago, there are a lot of people who are Euroskeptics who are saying, this may be not such a great deal. I bet some of those people are thinking to themselves now, yeah, we told you. There's a risk to all this.
They may. You tie your economies together, and you've tied a lot together. Louise, do you think we're still at risk of Europe cratering here? We keep being told every few weeks, here's the solution, here's the big answer, and then the next thing you know, it's like more gloom and doom warnings. Where are we on that path?
Well, we really do not have a fully formed path forward. You know, Sarkozy and Merkel, the leaders of Europe, have been telling us they have a plan, but the plan has not been rolled out. Greece, you know, does not have buy-in yet from the investors who have to do the debt swap. They actually, the Greece financial ministers are going to be going on a roadshow to try to convince those investors to do that. And so if the investors do not agree to swap the Greek debt and take a haircut on it, then the European leaders have to go back to the drawing board and perhaps impose a mandatory haircut, which can trigger a lot of derivatives contracts, could cause some panic in the market. So we're just not there yet. We don't have a roadmap. We don't have a deal. And, you know, I think what Bill said is very interesting and informative about looking at Greece as a preview of the United States. So here we have this country where they've had all of these austerity cuts in the last year or so, and their economy is getting worse. Look at that from the United States standpoint. Today, you know, we had unemployment figures come out. There's a slight improvement. Mm-hmm. But in those numbers, you see that private companies hired, but governments are cutting and cutting and cutting in the United States. And with all these cuts, you've got to ask what's going to happen to the economy here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Greece and Europe. Herman Cain on the hot seat, infrastructure blocked in the U.S. Senate. Occupy Oakland, very much in the news, and more. Louise Story joins us, business reporter for the New York Times. Bill McKenzie is with us from the Dallas Morning News, joining us from Texas. Jack Beatty's here. We've got to turn to this Herman Cain story. He's been so high up in the polls, and then, boom, last weekend, the story that there had been, sexual harassment allegations and settlements with women on his staff when he was head of the National Restaurant Association in the 1990s in Washington. On Monday afternoon, here he was at the National Press Club, said he didn't know about a settlement with the accuser.
As far as a settlement, I am unaware of any sort of settlement. I hope it wasn't for much because I didn't do anything. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not aware of a settlement that came out of that accusation.
Not aware. Are you sure, Mr. Cain? On that same evening, Greta Van Susteren interviewed Cain on Fox News. He admitted he'd known one of his accusers was paid a settlement.
The charge was filed. They did investigate. It was found to be baseless. And yes, there was some sort of settlement or termination. And I don't even know what the contents of that was. Since it was found baseless, that was no big settlement, or it would have had to come to me.
Conservatives jumped all over this news, saying this is liberals going after an African-American conservative candidate. Here's conservative pundit Ann Coulter blaming the liberal media for the Cain scandal on Fox News' Geraldo Rivera on Monday.
It's outrageous the way liberals treat a black conservative. This is another high-tech lynching. Even the allegations
here. The words of Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice.
That's right. There's nothing liberals fear more than a black conservative. Ask Alan Wesk, ask Michael Steele, and ask Clarence Thomas. And even what
and the on she go- and on she goes with that. But the Cain campaign itself pointed very strongly in another direction. Here's Herman Cain's chief of staff, Mark Block, on Fox News Wednesday. He accused, not liberal, he accused Texas Governor Rick Perry, Republican, of tipping off reporters about sexual harassment allegations against Cain.
The actions of the Perry campaign are despicable. Rick Perry and his campaign owe Herman Cain and his family an apology. Both the Rick Perry campaign and Politico did the wrong thing by reporting something that wasn't true.
Bill McKenzie, begin to take us into this story, and let's just start with Herman Cain himself. We'll come to Rick Perry down in Texas country where you are. But what about the way this story has come out, the way it's played out, and Herman Cain's situation at the end of this week of difficult news for him?
Right. When I look at this, what I've been thinking about is we're getting ready to find out whether Herman Cain has Bill Clinton-like skills. You know, you go back 20 years again.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the Clinton, all these charges kept coming at Clinton in the 92 campaign. And he was able to successfully navigate around them, Jennifer Flowers, all of that. And then there was the charge about drug use and draft guards and all that. So, but Clinton was able to, being a very masterful politician, and I say that in a good way, he had political antenna. He knew how to navigate around this situation, and we know what happened. He got elected president.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't know is whether Herman Cain has those same skills, and we're getting ready to find out. My hunch is he doesn't, because he hasn't been tested in this arena before like Clinton had been, but benefit of the doubt goes to Cain. We will see whether he has ability to get around this.
Yeah. So, Louise, we'll look at the Cain reaction, but let's look at these allegations on their face. Now, much of the detail is unknown here because there were non-disclosure agreements apparently signed by these women after there were payouts to them, $45,000 in one case, I forget the number in the other. But what about on the face of it? You cover business, Louise. What does this look like to you? Is this rare, common, weird, bad? Here's the head of the National Restaurant Association, you know, with them making payments to people who work for him because they said the boss was going after them somehow sexually.
Well, you know, it's so rare in business for us to find out about these things. It's very often that you find out when someone runs for politics, all of these things that were going on behind closed doors on executive suites. But, you know, it's kept very, very quiet, and it's very standard when you leave a company, whether it be a financial company or any other kind of, you know, consumer product company, when you leave, you sign agreements that you cannot say anything bad about anyone at the company or what went on at the company or talk about it. And so that really is a culture in corporate America that discourages, you know, releasing the truth and telling people about potential wrongdoing.
Jack Beatty, how are you looking at the whole Herman Cain path this week?
Well, I'm looking at it through the lens of Stephen Dedalus, Joyce's hero in Ulysses, who at one point muses, life is an intensely serious low comedy. I mean, this has been what this has been. Serious, because this is about the presidency of the United States. Serious, because sexual harassment, which he's accused of, is very serious. And according to one study I saw, as many as 1 in 10 women in selected workplaces, 1 in 10 have basically been told either have sex with me by the boss or you lose your job, or if you want a promotion, you have to do this. Think of that. That's a degrading thing to do to another human being. And now we have at least 3 women who've come forward anonymously. We don't know whether they're going to, whether this will come out onto the surface.
We're told one may as soon as today be speaking about this.
And that goes to the National Restaurant Association, a big lobby, which spent $600,000 in lobbying just this quarter, which gave $1 million to candidates last year. It seems anything can happen, but it seems unlikely that they're going to try to, you know, break this confidentiality agreement, because it would put them in jeopardy with one party or the other. It's a very ugly business, and Mr. Cain has simply created huge credibility problems with these vertiginous turns in his tail. You know, this way and that way and the other way. He makes it up. Joe Scarborough, the Republican host on TV, said he makes it up as he goes along, and that's what we're seeing. And it is a farce with these very serious overtones.
Doesn't everybody make it up as they go along in politics? Didn't Bill Clinton sort of dance through that obstacle course when he was in not the same situation, but up against some of the same issues, as Bill says?
Oh, I agree with you. I'm not defending what other politicians do, but we do expect some level of truth from people who run for public office. And if they're proven to lie, then you simply can't trust them in higher office. And people might argue, well, you couldn't have trusted Bill Clinton. Well, that's a debate. But this is the issue for this man now. Is he telling anything like the truth?
Let's hear from our listeners, Sean in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Sean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I support the man that raised more money from the troops than all the Republican candidates combined, Ron Paul, and I wish that you guys would give him more coverage instead of covering Herman Cain, who would just, because he does good in the polls. Ron Paul consistently does way better than Cain, way better than Perry, way better than Bachman. He's very, very consistent in all his support, and you guys just, don't give him any
credit. Well, you
for
say
him.
Way better, but there's Herman Cain at the top of the polls, and that does mean something. But yes, Ron Paul, we know he's got his firm supporters, but you've got to look at the support he gets overall. That is reflected in our coverage, but we've got it, Sean. Let's go to Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
in thinking about Herman Cain versus Bill Clinton and their similar contentious with this issue, it seems to me that I wonder, to put to your pundits, I wonder if the Republicans don't hold their candidates in this primary season up to a higher standard than they did Bill Clinton, and that perhaps his cohorts in the Democratic Party were less likely to hammer onto Bill Clinton as the Republicans are onto Herman Cain.
Well, that's interesting. Of course, you know, we heard Ann Coulter there making the other argument, but Bill McKenzie, how about it? I mean, Cain is not denying that there were things that went on here, and they had to do with sexual harassment up to and including pretty substantial settlements paid out to these women to kind of have them go away. So here's the GOP looking at this man. He's had a big appeal, but now he's got this on his saddle with him. How does it play out?
How does it play out going forward, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think he is up against it. Having said that, I mean, his fundraising has spiked since Sunday when these stories started coming out. So I may be wrong on that. I mean, there are people rushing to his side. I don't know any more than the next person what happened. It looks like something must have happened there. What that is, we don't know. We'll find out more of that as we go on. But I kind of agree with Jack that, you know, if things continue to come out, dribble out, and it looks like he has even kind of just shaded the truth, maybe not outright lie, just shaded it some, I think it's really hard for somebody like that in either party today to try to go forward and get their nomination. And I think that's in part because the reaction to Clinton in 92. And I may be wrong on that, but that's kind of my thought about that. All along, I've thought that, you know, Romney is like, if I may say, he's like the Dallas Mavs in last year's NBA playoffs. You know, teams kept making runs at the Mavs. They kept making runs at the Mavs, but they never knocked the Mavs off. Ditto with Romney. People make runs at Romney. You know, Perry made one. Bachman made one. Cain is making his. My hunch is I don't think they knock Romney off, you know. And at some level, if you're Romney's campaign, you kind of welcome these runs because you're being tested by it, and you're showing that you can withstand it. And if you come out the nominee with all these runs being made at you, you know, you show people that you got a pretty good campaign.
I want to ask about your Texas Governor Rick Perry.
Yep.
And first to the Cain allegation that the Perry camp was behind these stories of sexual harassment. Here's Rick Perry himself in an interview with the conservative blog RedState.com. This was just yesterday, vigorously denying leaking the story of Cain's harassment scandal.
Yeah, I will suggest to you there's not anybody in my campaign that knew anything about this that's associated with my campaign in any form or fashion. I mean, end of story. I mean, this is one of those that's about as clear cut as I can and tell you.
Not me, not my campaign. We'll ask you about that, Bill, but also about this, the speech that got a lot of attention from Rick Perry this week to the conservative group Cornerstone Action. This was in Manchester, New Hampshire, actually last Saturday, but the video came out. And, you know, on the video anyway, it looks rambling, humorous, that the whole thing went viral. People wondered if he'd been drinking or what, just having a good time. Event organizers insisted all he had was water. Here's a clip.
This is such a cool state. I mean, come on, live free or die. I mean, you know, you gotta love that, right? I come from a state, you know, where they had this little place called the Alamo, and they declared victory or death. You know, we're kind of into those slogans, man. It's like live free or die, victory or death. Bring it.
I don't know. Maybe he's just having a good time right there. But, Bill, first to the Cain camp allegation,
right,
vigorously denied that Perry's people were behind this. Now, we know that stuff like that goes on in politics. Is that the kind of thing Rick Perry's record indicates that Cain would be reasonable in suspecting?
Well, reasonable in suspecting, perhaps. But, I mean, the Perry campaign is very explicit in denying this. I talked to them yesterday. They are clear. We had nothing to do with this. This is not us. So, you know what? I'm going to take them at their word. Having said that, in the past, Rick Perry has been one really tough campaigner. He ran against a Democratic nominee for governor in 2002, a banker from South Texas, Tony Sanchez. Mm. Tony Sanchez had a bank in Laredo. Ads that Perry ran essentially tried to link Sanchez to drug cartels. in Mexico based on deposits that were being made into his bank, and it was pretty ugly. He ran tough campaign ads against Kay Hutchinson when she ran against him, Republican senator, tried to knock him off for governor last year. It wasn't allegations of unethical doings by Hutchinson, but he really, he just linked her to Washington and just ran these ads and just really just whipped her around.
He will play hardball, but that's a little bit different. You could say this is just hardball. This is not fiction made up here. It's just
history. Whether, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt that they didn't have anything to do with this. But having said that, and I've said this all along, Rick Perry is one of the toughest campaigners any of these guys will ever come up against. And what we know about Rick Perry in Texas, perhaps most of all, is Rick Perry cares about winning, mostly Rick Perry's campaigns. And so he is usually operating several steps ahead to try to figure out how he gets to his end goal.
Rick Perry Rawhide. What about Rick Perry there in New Hampshire sounding pretty loosey-goosey? Is that just having a good time, live free or die? You got to love that.
Yeah, this is not drinking, this anything like this. This is kind of Rick Perry. I mean, there is, I don't know how to put this other than directly, there's an unusual manner he has sometimes on the stump. The only way I can put it is there's a Nixonian-like quality to him. And by that, I don't mean that he's corrupt and crooked. I don't think that. But Nixon, remember how he used to have the sweat on his upper lip? And he just kind of didn't make people feel comfortable.
But I don't remember him being a good time guy.
No, but I think there's still this – if Perry's unusual mannerisms on the stumps kind of – evidently the audience kind of liked it from what
they
I
were laughing there.
Yeah. But I still think he has this, he doesn't have this natural ability to make people feel reassured about him. And I think that is in part what is playing out in that presentation. It's just kind of weird.
Trying a little too hard. Jack Beatty, you're up in New Hampshire. Were you out for a pop with Rick before the appearance there?
No, I wasn't there. But it's interesting. I saw an interview with a reporter who was there, and she said they loved it, that the audience really loved it, and that Perry was in part playing to the momentum of their enjoyment, sort of raising the ante with his antics. Now, we've seen these things happen before. I mean, think of 2004, Howard Dean in Iowa. After coming in second in the caucuses there, he made that speech, "We're going to go on to Texas," that we were shouting. Well, partly he was shouting to get over the audience that was making so much noise and was in it. But when it was excerpted and shown on the, apart from that context, it looked very bizarre. And so did this.
Right. Well, and I think if you put that on top, if you put that on top of the poor debate performances, this adds to the challenge Perry has in a short period of time to go out and reassure people that he's presidential. And the campaign may be saying that, look, everybody loved the speech, such and such, but the general take on it is that's just kind of weird. Somehow he has to deal with that going forward.
Louise, this is the gang we're headed into 2012 with very soon here for the election. I mean, oh, my goodness. How are you feeling? How's your confidence level, Louise, in American leadership?
Well, one of the interesting things that I spend some of my time doing is talking to the people I cover, the people on Wall Street, the bankers and the traders, about where their political money and their political sentiments are going. And it'll be very interesting to see if they side more with the Democrats or Republicans this time around.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, snow before Halloween in the Northeast, and millions, including Montclair, New Jersey resident Shannon Gibson, were stuck without lights or heat.
30 degrees, no power. There's no insulation in most of these old Victorian homes. It's absolutely freezing.
No power, no fun. In Connecticut, passengers on a JetBlue plane were stranded on the tarmac for more than 7 hours in the storm. The pilot begged the control tower for help.
Is there any way you can get a tug and a tow bar out here to us and get us towed somewhere to a gate or something? I don't care. Take us anywhere.
Anywhere. Get us off here. And in Gurugan, India, fans of the American heavy metal rock band Metallica rioted after a last-minute cancellation of the show. Then they stormed the stage.
Take everything! Seek and destroy.
Heavy metal goes global there. We're looking at a week in the news. You can join the conversation. Is Occupy on the right track this week in Oakland? What do you make of the news on poverty, on infrastructure spending that will not happen? Is class warfare on? Bill McKenzie is with us from the Dallas Morning News, joining us from Texas. Louise Story of the New York Times and our own Jack Beatty. You know, while it's all going on in Greece, there's a struggle going on back here. And Jack, this week in the U.S. Senate, it was about whether or not to put money into infrastructure in this country to try and jumpstart some more jobs. As Louise said, a tiny little tick down in unemployment, apparently, down to 9% from 9.1%, and more jobs created in the last couple of months than had been thought, but not as many as expected this month. In the middle of that, what was the Senate looking at, Jack, and what happened?
They were looking at a $60 billion infrastructure spending bill that would have included $10 billion to seed an infrastructure bank. In the past, Republicans have supported the idea of an infrastructure bank. They've certainly supported infrastructure spending in the past, but they wouldn't go along this time. Why? Because taxes would go up on 0.2% of Americans, people earning over $1 million, 350,000 Americans would be paying a little bit more, about $13,000 more to build the roads and bridges for the future. And the Republicans say you can't do that to these people because they are the job creators of America. These are small businessmen. Well, What do the facts show? Data shows that only about 2 to 3% of small businesses earn over $250,000 in taxable income, and of course this is not $250,000. This is over $1 million. So it doesn't seem like there could be too many small businesses in that. And yesterday I went and I interviewed a friend of mine who's a small businessman, runs a chain that has a national brand. And I asked him, well, tell me about your story. Well, their gross is $500,000 a year. But by the time he deducts his expenses, his rent, his electric lights, his stock, the taxable income, $45,000. That's true of so many small businesses. And, you know, is that really what is killing small businesses, the taxes? There have been studies now that have come out. Yes, some small businesses are worried about taxes, but in the main, far more by considerable degree are worried about lack of demand. And this bill would have restored some demand.
Bill McKenzie, how does that look from Dallas? The president and Democrats in the Senate pushing for infrastructure spending, another thing to kind of prod things forward, get some jobs out there. On the other hand, that's spending. Now, the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, but they don't have enough to get past the filibuster, the 60-vote mark with the Republicans in opposition. Where do you come down on this bill?
Well, but there's another element of the story. Republicans had their own infrastructure bill the Democrats didn't want, and the Republican bill would have extended some current highway and transit spending programs, and they were going to pay for it through offsets and funding for other domestic programs, the funding that had not been spent. So, you know, who's right, who's wrong? They both have bills that they're trying to deal with infrastructure. The headline is about the Republicans killing the Democratic bill, but the Democrats also killed the Republican bill.
Is anybody really working on the economy here, or are they just positioning
Right. Supposedly there's going to be a tax credit offered for companies to hire veterans, and both parties heretofore have liked that. Supposed to come out today, and we'll hear more about it. That could be one, you know, tiny way to element to deal with this. You know, I still just think the biggest story for us, though, is this super committee, and they have until November 23rd to come up with a plan. And Erskine Bowles this week, I loved it. You know, Clinton's former chief of staff kind of essentially dared him and says, you know, I like you guys individually, but collectively, I'm worried that you're going to do it. I think you're going to fail the country.
Yeah, that's going to be big in the news, and very soon. I want to ask you about it, Louise. Here's Erskine Bowles. Before that super committee, they're supposed to come up with a big, big deal here to look at the deficits, spending, taxes, the whole works. Here's Bowles saying they've got to rise above politics and come to some kind of real deal to make progress here.
I believe if you all go big, if you're bold, and if you do it in a smart manner, that the American people will support you if you make these big, bold, smart decisions. I hope for the country's sake you will.
Pete Domenici was there as well, longtime Republican senator in New Mexico, warning the super committee, don't fail to compromise. Here he was.
If we don't do this, those who are for fixing health care
and those who are for tax increases, and they say we'll do not one without the other, we will do only one, then they are both complicit in letting America destroy itself, letting this great democracy destroy itself because we don't want to make tough decisions.
There's a warning, and here's former Senator Alan Simpson saying, go, go big, have guts.
People admire guts and courage. They may fight you, they may vilify you, but they will admire you.
Luis Story, what are you expecting at this point out of the super committee, and how keenly, I guess, is the U.S. economy hanging on what comes out of this committee?
Well, you remember the stock market really had a panicked reaction in August when Congress had an impasse over raising the debt limit. So this certainly could throw the markets off. It could cause, you know, companies possibly to pause their activity to see what happens. But the other thing that's very interesting in relief here with what's going on with Congress mm-hmm. is the idea of the referendum in Greece. So, you know, I kind of was wondering the other day, what would happen if we had a referendum in the United States over, you know, whether the deficit should be removed, the balanced budget should be had, or whether there should be more economic stimulus programs put into place. Because, again, when you look at these unemployment figures, even people like Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, he's saying it's frustratingly slow getting back the jobs. He says we'll be likely at like 8.6% unemployment even a year from now. Other officials say it's going to be 2017, the earliest, before we're back to normal employment levels. So you've got all these Americans who can just be unemployed for years and years and years. Their houses are worth less. So I would be very curious to see what a national American referendum would say about the trade-offs we have here with balancing the budget and stimulating the economy.
What if that referendum was taken on Wall Street itself? You work in that circle. You know, here's opposition to taxes on high earners. But to some, you know, the financiers must be worried about the economy itself. Are they opposed to that? I know you can't give us a one big they answer, but what about stimulus and Wall Street?
Well, you really have both camps on Wall Street. You have people who say you have to get our budget under control. They look out at the financial markets and they say, yes, international investors buy treasuries. They're still buying treasuries. But they say at some point, if we don't show as a country that we can balance our books, we may have trouble selling treasuries and funding our government. That hasn't happened yet, but they warn that. So you've got that camp. But you also have many people at banks saying, you've got to improve the economy. Remember, the banks make more money in a booming economy. And in fact, banks' earnings have been down the last few quarters. They're not doing that great. I mean, of course, the average bank worker is doing better than the average American out there. There'll be many big bonuses this year. But for the banks, compared to when we're in a good economy, they're hurting now. They're not making a lot of money. And, you know, you've seen banks like Bank of America try to levy some new fees on Americans, and they've had to roll those back because mm-hmm. of the backlash. And the reason Americans are reacting so strongly is because a lot of people don't have jobs. The economy is bad. And so for the banks, a stronger economy would be very helpful to them.
Let's go to Martin in Iowa City, Iowa. Martin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd just like to make the comment upon this is that people are always asking, you know, what's the Republican agenda? Where is their plan as opposed to Obama's plan? I think the main thing people might want to keep in mind, especially coming into this election, is that what is happening right now is the de facto Republican plan. They don't want to raise taxes. They don't want to spend money. So by rejecting any of these efforts, they're actually pushing through their own agenda. And so
is that a good thing to your mind, Martin? Is that a good thing? I mean, we're stuck with this high unemployment.
Absolutely not. I am a strong supporter of Keynesian economics. I don't see how austerity measures will provide any type of support for the situation that we're in. But if people are looking for a good, quote-unquote, Republican candidate to come into the 2012 election and possibly beat Obama, I think what they're looking for is just more heartache, more austerity, and the same kind of, yep, we're not going to pass anything until we balance our budget, or unless we can switch around or shuffle around all this money to pay for things like infrastructure and education and things of that sort.
Yep, Martin, I appreciate your call, and let me get one more. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering why it's fallen off the map. That it was very well stated early on Republicans made it a priority to not give Obama anything he wanted. I find that, of course, objectionable, but it's still what's happening. And that, of course, it throws everyone else aside to make that the agenda to just not let Obama have anything he wants.
I mean, they want to win the White House, no question about that. And you're right. I mean, that was laid out, you know, Mitchell put it right out there. But maybe they don't want more taxes, and maybe they don't want more spending. Maybe they're looking at Greece and saying, we don't want to go there, Martha.
And looking at Greece?
Yes.
Well, comparing us to Greece is kind of rough. We've had a capitalist system in place for a very long time. We've had greed running this country, and greed is really the downfall of human beings, don't you think?
Can be. Martha, we've got to get a couple more calls in here, and I appreciate yours. I want to get the sound of Oakland in our ears right here. Occupy Oakland, which filled the streets there in parts of the city, went right down to the port and looked to shut it down. Here on Monday, this was rapper Boots Riley, one of the leaders of Occupy Oakland, announcing the group would march on one of the busiest ports in America, the Port of Oakland.
We will converge at 5 p.m. at 14th and Broadway, and march to the port to shut it down before the 7 p.m. night shift. We are doing this in order to blockade the flow of capital on the day of the general strike.
Blockade the flow of capital right there in Oakland. Here's the executive director of the port, Omar Benjamin, in a news conference on Wednesday saying, hey, this is hurting the city's economy and real people.
Continued missed shifts represent economic hardship for maritime workers, truckers, and their families, as well as lost jobs and lost tax revenue for our region.
Bill McKenzie, it got rough there for a while in Oakland. You've got Occupy organizers saying, hey, we didn't want it to go that way. We've got people getting involved that we're not on top of. But, you know, this was some image, Bill. If this came from another country, we'd put, you know, I don't know, on an inside page and say, you know, Americans in the streets protesting their economy.
Right. Well, you know, at one level, I'm glad to see signals be sent to Wall Street, et cetera, that, you know, average folks are really frustrated about incomes being stagnant and differentials and wages and all that. So, you know, This is important. However, this is a little bit like the 1960s when people wanted to bring down the system. You think, okay, well, what are you going to do after you bring down the system? And that's kind of what's going on, I think, in Oakland. So you want to get the economy better, you want a better situation, but then you're going to go out and try to shut down part of the local economy. I'm not sure I think that's the most strategic thing to do.
And yet you can't blame people looking at the system these days. I mean, even just this week, as Louise said, you know, here we got MF Global with Corzine, who has been right in the halls of power. He's been complaining about executive compensation and all the rest, and then he takes his own firm. Here's a little bit. Investigative journalist Bill Cohen went on CNBC on Monday and said that the failure of the investment firm MF Global, this is Corzine's former governor, senator firm, was simply shocking. Here he is talking with CNBC's Eric Schutzker.
You would have thought securities firms would have learned a lesson from 3 years ago, and John Corzine.
This wasn't supposed to happen again.
This wasn't
supposed
to happen again. And John Corzine, you know, when I interviewed him, we talked mostly about Goldman, but he also, we were sitting in his MF Global offices. He had just gotten there. He talked to me about how he was going to transform it, how it was a little too sleepy, how they didn't know how to take risks, how they weren't going to be big risk takers, and he was going to transform it into more of a Goldman Sachs like risk taking operations.
Great. Doing that after everything that we've been through, Louise Story. I mean, here's a man who was at the top of Goldman Sachs, then in public service, saw the issues from that angle. Now, you know, back in finance and doing this again. Has nothing changed on the regulatory side? What the kind of leverage is allowed? The kind of invest? I mean, are we still this vulnerable? I guess we are.
Well, you know, MF Global is really a mid-sized firm. And so you have brokerages that are smaller than the Goldman Sachs's of the world that do not have as much regulation. And those are the ones to watch now. We do not yet know if failures of this sort of entity can cause systemic problems. And you know, so far, MF Global does not seem to have. But on the other hand, people are pointing fingers at the other brokerages and seeing who is next. There are not single regulators of any of these brokerages. There's no regulator that can see a whole firm. And so it's this patchwork regulation. And we're going to have to watch and see if perhaps Further down the chain with these smaller brokerages, perhaps there should be more regulation. We don't know. But the flip side, of course, is people say if you regulate them too much, mm-hmm. then you're going to cut into the economy. And, you know, one of the reasons people on Wall Street say they get paid a lot, of course, is because they take risk. And so when people take risk, there has to be some element of failure or possibility of failing. Otherwise, it's not called risk.
But
you
if they're putting all of us at risk, we deserve some kind of vote in that. Are you saying that the bigger firms, Goldman, Corzine's former company, is now overseen more tightly than, let's say, MF would be these days, Louise?
Yes, they absolutely are. You know, Goldman Sachs became a bank during the financial crisis, as did Morgan Stanley. And so they do have greater oversight. They're under the Fed. They also can borrow directly from the Fed, which means they might be able to survive a crisis better if there is another one.
Well, watching that one go down this week with a prominent former Democratic official at its head in John Corzine, and it's not pretty to see, unsettling to see that again. Louise Story with the New York Times business reporter there. Louise, it's always terrific to have you. We really appreciate your coming on
today.
Thank
you.
Bill McKenzie, we're glad you made it out of traffic in Dallas and here with us. It's great to have you, Bill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you all.
Jack Beatty, have a good weekend, my friend. Watch out for Rick Perry up there.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.